Hello, my friends. Today's a very exciting day. A special thank you to all of the fans and listeners who've reached out to congratulate myself and my wife, Michelle, on the newest addition to our family, a little baby boy named Lachlan. Take a moment today to add me on LinkedIn or Twitter, and you can see some photos. You can also catch highlights from the show and see faces of what some of these great technology leader guests look like. You can also join the community that happens within our comment threads. Now, Lachlan is only one day old, and he's already improving and growing as a leader thanks to LeaderBits. So if you're looking to develop yourself and weaponize yourself professionally, we've created this complimentary growth review just for you, just for individuals. So we'll answer questions like, how do I level up? How do I become more valuable? And what are others doing so that I can gain an edge on my peers and accelerate and advance my skills? So here's what you're going to leave the growth review with: a clear step-by-step plan tailored to your specific situation, tactical insights that you can apply immediately, and a review of your leadership abilities so you can see how you stack up against over 1,200 other leaders that are just like you. And we'll answer all of your questions about how to develop yourself professionally and become more valuable. So to get this review, visit leaderbits.io/growth, and you can schedule your complimentary growth review today. Now get excited, because today we are talking to Bill Tingle, the CTO at Pods, and we discuss the importance of communicating your value, when to lead and when to follow, and why holding on to certainties is limiting and dangerous. All of this right here, right now on the Modern CTO Podcast.
Here we go.
This is the Modern CTO Podcast.
This is fun.
Have you done any other in studio?
We did, yes, we've done one other one with, ClickBooth. They're like a marketing company.
No.
They happen to be number one in the world, and they're in Sarasota.
Oh, great.
For their niche. Like,
okay.
Whatever.
Yeah.
They do CPA marketing.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Okay. But they're really popular for it, and Janice had moved from another country over here as a CTO. He'd been CTO there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was driving in his Tesla, and the first week he was here, he just put in the word CTO into his podcast, and up came our show,
great.
And then he noticed that we were talking, that we're actually from here,
And
so he reached out, and we ended up having him on the show, and then I find out he lives like a street down from me.
Isn't that wild? Small world.
Yeah.
That's great.
Like walking through my neighborhood, I'm like, that guy looks familiar.
Well, when I got the note from Chloe, and I was like, what? And then I saw your LinkedIn profile. I'm like, where are they from? And then they're Bradenton. I'm like, I'd rather go there than do a Zoom session.
Right.
You know, I mean, just there's something about being present with somebody than, I mean, it's great that we have the capability to be remote and do video conferencing. I think that's wonderful. But it's not the same.
It's not the same.
It's not the same just because we're, you know, like there's biologically, you know, whether it's limbic resonance or just the way that the energy with people when they're together, you know, it's very different. So
that was one of the things that stood out to me when I was reading through your notes.
Uh-huh.
It's like you, and I was just thinking, I think about a week ago, the physics of leadership, right?
Uh-huh.
And as I was reading through some of your stuff, you mix a lot of that in there.
Uh-huh.
I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, for years, I've been studying, leadership. You know, there's just great, you know, history of research and books and things around leadership. But probably since 2000, introducing sort of the biology, the human part of it, right? And, you know, Daniel Pink had Whole New Mind with a left brain, right brain, which was interesting. And then I've always been interested in the brain and the mind, not at the scientific level necessarily, but just like how it works, because it's who we are, right? I mean, and then the other part of that is we live in language. And I think we take that for granted. And I remember years ago, I don't know if it was Napoleon Hill or someone, there was a book, The Power of Words, I think is what it was called. And I'm like, well, duh, you know, The Power of Words. But I started thinking more and more about, you know, we have language, and we exist in language, and we trigger each other in language. And if we didn't have that, what would life be like, right?
It'd
I mean, we give things names, and we create. You know, you talked about you're interested in electricity. Well, imagine, like, what would that be like if you didn't have language to talk or learn about electricity? So yeah, there's a whole range of studies out there that I've brought to my own practices that have just been extremely helpful.
I always found, and I always say the word wrong, it's like anthropomorphism. It's basically when we assign inanimate objects personality types, or we imagine that they're uh-huh. like us, uh-huh. other objects, but they're not. Like, we do this with animals a lot.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And after I heard that, I guess that was one of the first things that started to open my mind to learning, uh-huh. learning, because it's, you can leverage that information and it actually will help you in relationships and in the real world.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I was just thinking about, like, my dog, you know, I love to walk my dog in the morning and late at night. It's sort of one of my ways of relaxing and reflecting. And, you know, I watch my dog, how it operates, you know, it responds and it does certain things, but it doesn't have language. Now, it understands my commands because it's a sort of a pattern-recognizing creature. But, you know, if I start having a conversation and saying other things, the dog's not going to do anything. He's just going to kind of tip its head and look at me. But it has similarities in its organization as we do. I mean, it has a stomach and ears and, you know, and so. But then if you looked at the brain, clearly there's only, you know, the brain structure is only so organized. And so you say, okay, well, what's the structure of that, and how can I work, you know, how can I be with my dog, but I can't be the same way as I can with my wife or my children or anything like that, because, you know, the prefrontal cortex isn't the same, structured the same. And then you look at humans and how we're structured, and you think about, wow, it's amazing why we need each other to help each other, and B, what we're able to accomplish because of the way we're structured. And you start thinking about that. It's like, well, what are the limitations to what we can do? And you've seen it, like, over the last century, and even more so over the last 20 years. It's just the acceleration of change and what we're able to accomplish as human beings working together. Because if we're all looking in isolation, just know that's going to happen.
So that, yeah, that was, for me, the first time I became a team leader. I was real geeky. I loved to build things, right? And I saw you have the coding background,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
And so there was something so engaging about being able to solve the problem. It was addictive. Like, I uh-huh. very much enjoyed it, getting yeah. the result, putting the work in. And then when I found out, you know, that you could work with a team, and now you've amplified.
Oh, yeah.
And now you've got 5-6 people who are amazing. And what you can do when you can control and motivate that team to achieve an outcome, now it's like all of the greatness from that, but multiplied.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's far greater than the sum. I mean, what you can, and you know, you think about what, and you've probably seen this, what 4 people can do, even spread out throughout the world, compared to an entire company at times, right? Where it's, you know, it's all about coordination and having intentions around what you're trying to produce and what your vision is, and having the capabilities and the way that you interact together. It's amazing what can be produced versus alone. You know, I see some people,
yes.
and nothing against that. I see people who are, you know, doing a startup and they're going alone, and there's no network, there's no you know, interconnection with anybody else, and you just see the loss of power because it's one person trying to do it. And I'm not disparaging that. I mean, I think, you know, all the power to that person who's writing that first set of code to create the next great, you know, the next Facebook or whatever. But at some time, Mark Zuckerberg did have other people that
right.
he worked with, right?
And it's, you know, I'd say for myself, I resonate with what you're talking about right now, because I had built technologies and done it by myself, mm-hmm. and then I had built technologies with a business partner, and he was running all, like, the CEO type mm-hmm. stuff. And then I realized through that not only is the engineering side very dependent on relationships and people, mm-hmm. but the sales and business side of actually getting what you built that's cool into the market is 100% dependent on your network and relationships and people. And so going at it yourself, it's like, I enjoy the mission that I'm on,
mm-hmm.
and I want to bring other people into it. So this is very real to me, because back in March of last year, it was myself and Jake, the producer, and we had this show,
mm-hmm.
and then we ended up doing this leadership company, and now we have 11 people. And that's great. And this is the first time that I've worked with people outside of engineering. So I had to learn sales. I had to learn all of this. And what I realized is that the money to be able to bring in people is so powerful and beneficial that I just severely underestimated what I could do with five people versus what I could do just working 16 hours a day. Like, it's hard in my mind. It would be hard if I even went back in the past to try to convince myself of how much of a multiplier you get and then how much you're going to need beyond that to serve the market.
Yeah, that's really good. And the thing I think about a lot is, you know, if you try to go alone and you're trying to do sales and marketing or finance, accounting, whatever, that, well, what do you know about those domains? And how effective are you going to be, and how long is it going to take to learn, versus find somebody and, you know, pay them and be a follower of their leadership in that domain when you need to. Versus, you know, this is one of the things about leading people in general, is if as the leader you think you have to know more than they do about every domain, you know, you're gonna fail or be really ineffective. Versus, you know, I've got a head of security, and that I'm not a security expert. I know the fundamentals of what I need to know, but at any moment I'm following him, and because he understands it, right? And I think his interpretations are far better than mine in that regard, and so I choose to follow him in certain situations, and in other situations he follows me, and it's like a dance back and forth, right? And yes. So for you, I would imagine it's the same thing, where you've got a content person or Jake or whoever that knows what they know, and you're following them at any point in time. But at the end of the day, you're the one that constitutes the business mission and the purpose, and you're making sort of the higher level interpretations and driving the company, I would imagine.
Yeah. And when I had a conversation with my CPA, I think like the day before yesterday, and he was asking about some of the earlier entries because it's tax season. And
fun.
Yeah. Yes. And so back when we started, it was just, you know, me and Jake. So he was saying, I think I see what you're trying to do here. And I said, look, I had no idea. I go, I saw a button that said book asset and put the computer in. And then I realized that this whole accounting thing, it's like its own world.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you can't just use, like, you can't just buy QuickBooks like it's an app and just use it. Like, there's this whole entire profession behind it. And he, like, laughed so hard. He's like, yes, there is an entire profession of accounting, and all we do is deal with how we book things and do accounting.
It's a whole different discourse.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny how we think we can pick up a book, read it, and we got it, right? Like, I talk to my team a lot about understanding versus knowledge. You know, it's like, well, yeah, we can all read a book over the weekend, but, you know, come in Monday morning, well, let's see how well you know, can write a Perl script or, you know, whatever it might be, right? It's like, well, yeah, you might be able to pass a test or regurgitate the information, but, you know, knowledge is the ability to produce an act and produce an outcome. And how effective can you be? And so that's where, like, well, that's why we need help. That's why we pay people who've been through those discourses, like for you and your accountant.
Yes.
So I get that, yeah.
That's why the executives from Airbnb, Uber, or Twitter are so highly sought after, because when you hire an early employee from there or someone that was in, you know that they saw it. You know that they went through it. Mm-hmm. They didn't read about it. They didn't study it in a master's program. They did it. And so now they come with a premium, this experience premium.
Yeah. Exactly. Good.
You started young. Your father was in business. You started working with him.
Yeah, that's kind of a funny story. I talk about it. It's sort of, for me, it's like a sort of romantic story, and it wasn't a glamorous thing. My father, he was raised by two deaf parents.
Okay.
So, you know, definitely poverty. I mean, it was, you know, the things they could do to make money, you know, very, very minimum wage. And so, you know, he saw early on that, you know, he wanted a better life. And so he played college football. He got a scholarship because he was on a winning team. Got a degree in chemistry, became a scientist, and he made you know, pretty good money. But he knew it wasn't going to be enough, A, to buy company stock when it became available to him, and B, he was thinking about our college. And so he started a janitorial business. And so, you know, during the day he worked his job, and at night he would we would go and do these clean buildings. You know, so I'm a very young child. My first job was picking up cigarette butts. But over time, as he hired crews, I actually, because I knew how to do everything, I knew the operation, and I was actually running cleaning crews at a pretty young age. I couldn't even drive. And I remember, and I didn't have the distinctions back then, but I look back at how I was demonstrating leadership because I understood what the rules were and the practices and the requirements for what done was. And my dad was a stickler. You know, he would actually, you know, put on a glove and, you know, wipe down surfaces. And if there was anything, you had to get it clean, which I learned a lot about detail. But I learned at a very early age how to lead and how to coordinate and how to make interpretations of situations and know what the criteria was to be like, okay, the customer's going to be satisfied. And again, I didn't use those words back then. But so that was sort of the beginning. And I think over time, I've always sort of gravitated to leadership just because I learned how to like look at what's a situation and how to coordinate people around it. And in fact, I love software engineering. I love to code, but I kept getting put in management positions. And for a while, I thought, well, I must be really bad at writing code because they keep putting me in management positions. Maybe I was. But I really enjoyed it, and I finally surrendered, and I said, okay, enough's enough. I'm gonna be a manager or a leader. And then I was trying to use my common sense and all that I learned, and I realized, you know, like anything, you got to study it. You know, just because you're in management, it's just like marriage, right? You, yep. Like, we were never taught how to be a husband or a father, right? And it's like, well, there are places you can get help. And so anyway, that's sort of my little background and how I developed some perspective around it.
Yeah, just like accounting, it's a field of study.
Yeah, exactly.
And when you go in there, there's unbelievable amounts of resources. And then you start to notice trends between the different authors and sort of develop your own leadership style. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I really enjoyed that you said was you understood what done meant.
Yeah.
Because that is something that software struggles with.
Yeah.
It's the definition of done, right? So what is the definition of done at Pods?
Well, with regard to what?
Just software. Overall?
What, yeah. With what?
Software, let's say
software. Software. Oh, okay. So right now we're building a new system.
Okay.
And it's massive. You know, it's a new ERP system, but I would even say it's bigger than that. I'd like to think of it more new ecosystem.
Okay.
You know, so the foundation, we clearly have criteria that we can measure against for what done means, sort of on the initial launch, and it's quite a long list. You know, in fact, I would say it's, you know, there's probably 500 lines of, you know, checkpoints and criteria that we're going to look at. But I think, you know, it has to start with the human who's going to be touching the system, right? I think that's one thing. Early on. You know, I mean, early on, I worked in real-time embedded software, so that there was no humans involved. But the first time I was involved with human-centered systems, it all starts there. It's like, you know, how easy is it to use? Do they have to think? You know, I love the Krug book, Don't Make Me Think. And, you know, it all starts around user experience and no friction. And so I think the definition of done has to start with a human, like who's getting the utility and the significant value from it. And then there's who's supporting it. And so done means, you know, is it sustainable? Does it operate? Is it autonomous? Is it self-correcting maybe? So there's, you know, there's quite a bit that goes into that. But then, and I was looking through your book, which I didn't realize you had a book for a while, and then I bought it on Kindle, by the way.
Oh,
so
thank
yeah,
you.
I'm a customer.
Woo.
And yeah, there was some good stuff in there. I was
my first
yeah.
book.
Yeah, that was great.
It's like a first product.
Yeah,
you just put it out.
Yeah, I did a pretty quick read, and then there were some chapters that really just gripped, like the one on MVP, mm-hmm. you know, and spaghetti code. I was like, oh, that's great. But the one I think you had a section there around, which I totally believe that I think you talked about perfect is the enemy of good or something mm-hmm. like that, which, you know, that's kind of a popular phrase. But, you know, that's something you have to think about when you think about done, because in some cases you'll never get done. And there's always that last, what, you know, 10% or 15%, whatever the number is, that the return on the investment and the lost opportunity will just eat you alive if you don't really look out for it. So, you know, I probably didn't get as detailed in an answer there, but I do think, you know, done has to be criteria and good enough has to be there. And certainly whoever's touching, in the case of a software system, whoever's touching it has to be satisfied. And it's not just the customer, but you start with the customer.
Yeah. So when the program is providing value to the end user.
Yeah.
Right. It's not like when it just hits the development
yeah.
server.
Yeah, exactly. And I've seen some MVP, what people call their MVP before, and my first thought is, where's the utility? And so, to me, unless you just want to build the infrastructure and the backbone and make sure that you have, if you want that approach of, you know, having a scalable infrastructure first, that's fine, and I think that's admirable. But if there's no utility, I don't see where the done is. For my criteria, now for their criteria, maybe that was done, you know.
Pods.
Yeah.
How did you get involved? How did you find Pods?
Yeah, that's a great story. What a great company, and they've got just a wonderful history. So I was in St. Louis for about 20 years. Worked at Enterprise Rent-A-Car, family-owned company. People have no idea what a phenomenal company that is, and culture, and the growth, and family-owned, and just it's just a great story. So I had worked about every area of IT there. I was not the CIO. They have a marvelous CIO there. And I was at that point where I had run every area, and I was like, well, I'm ready to go run the whole thing myself. You know, I want to go. And, you know, Enterprise got pretty big. There was $20 billion in revenue when I left.
Wow.
And they grew, you know, they had over 1.5 million cars in their fleet. And anyway, this is more about Pods. I decided after 20 years I was going to go do something else.
You know?
And I also, you know, my dad worked at the same company his entire career, which was admirable, but I wanted more variety. And so I decided to go out and started talking to executive recruiters and networking and reaching out. I made a trip out to San Francisco and just started going up and down the valley. And I had some connections out there, and I thought, you know, maybe I'll, because my wife's from San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so I thought, well, she'd like to move back out there. And then I realized this is a young place, and I don't, you know, I think age discrimination could be really alive and well there. And I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, I did make some good connections. And then when I returned, my mom passed away. Mm-hmm. Which might resonate with you.
Yeah.
Similar background there, and she had been ill, but it was a sudden death, and so I kind of put everything on hold. I just got kind of oriented, and I said, okay, I'm need to take care of my mom's estate, and this one's complicated.
Yeah,
and I ran into a friend of mine who said, hey, you know, we're at this little software company we're working on, and it's a startup. If you're interested. And I was like, well, you know, for where I'm at right now, I wouldn't mind doing that. And so I did that for a while, and which was fun because I went back to writing code. I learned Swift, and
oh, nice.
And I realized how rusty I was, you know. But it was fun, and I got my mom's estate organized, and then, of course, St. Louis weather is brutal in the wintertime, and I was ready for someplace warm, and I kept getting these phone calls from companies in Minneapolis and Northern Wisconsin, and I'm like, I said, I want someplace warm.
Yes.
And I was walking down Central West End one day in St. Louis, and I get this call from an executive recruiter, and all I heard was Clearwater, and then I pictured sunshine, and then I said, now wait a minute, well, who's the company? And she said, Pods. And I said, oh my gosh, I know Pods. I've used Pods. I love Pods. And so I interviewed, you know, came down here to we're neighbors, right? So to Clearwater, a couple interviews, and learned their story. And I, of course, knew about I had rented containers before, which was a great idea. But once I learned their story and their culture, and met the leadership team and the people, and it just felt really good. And you know, it was a sort of a entrepreneurial feel. Mm-hmm. And so I moved from St. Louis. I've been there Midwest my whole life, and have lived in the Tampa Bay area now for 3 years. Just had my third anniversary, so that, nice. That's what brought me here. Yeah,
I love it. I'm a native to Sarasota.
Right, I heard that. Yeah, Sarasota.
Yeah.
So you grew up with Ringling Brothers, and
yeah,
you know, yeah,
yeah. And then my parents, or my father right now, lives up in Clearwater.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they have a weight loss clinic, bariatrics type.
Oh, very
thing.
Good.
Yeah,
very good.
They exploded. They started 3 years ago. His new wife is a physician, and they opened this up. Now they have like 30 doctors, and like this, they bought like a warehouse and renovated it to make it office space. And
wow,
they're just like
very successful.
I know. That's so fast. So
that's great.
They like do personalized medicine type stuff, and it's It's all very interesting.
Yeah, I think people, you know, society are just becoming more and more aware of the importance of health. And my wife and I are very conscious of it. And,
yes.
Of course, we've both been very interested in nutrition and fitness and health and the brain. Now the brain, we've been really looking closely at the brain. My father died of Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And so ever since that, you know, of course, there can be some genetic markers there. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to, you know, get in front of that and read a little bit about epigenesis. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not an expert on that, but I know that you can trigger genes. You know, you can trigger the genetics to on or off. And so take care. So, yeah, so I can see where that would take off. So good for your dad. That's awesome. Yeah.
Have you done the ancestry?
I did.
Where are you from?
You know, I did 23andMe.
Yeah.
And what I found puzzling is it asked me where I was from first, which I didn't understand that. I was like, okay. It's like, well, I'm not going to tell you. You first tell me.
Right.
And, you know, and then I'll tell you where I'm from. But it was validated that I'm from, my family's from Wales.
Okay.
So a lot of European descent, a little bit of German. You know, I'm most certain I have Native American Indian. I mean, I remember spending time with my great grandmother as a child in Oklahoma, and I mean, it was very clear visually she was, you know, Native American Indian, but that didn't show up. So I was surprised, yeah.
Same.
How about you?
I was like 99% from Europe area. Uh-huh. There was like two spots. They were really close to uh-huh. each other. And then 1% American Indian. So my grandmother looks like Pocahontas. Like she looks like Indian. It just uh-huh. came out real fast, uh-huh. apparently. So I don't know how it went from like her being all in very Indian looking to me being 1%, but it did.
Yeah.
It was enough though for my brother is actually when he went to med school, uh-huh. he registered, he has like a registered tribe and everything.
Oh wow.
Yeah. I didn't go through the registration process.
Well, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's I find that fascinating.
I know.
You know, my dad studied genealogy. It was fun to watch like pre IBM PC. He did all this by hand and by mail. He would write letters to the Mormon church in Salt Lake City mm-hmm. and he would like reach out and use the US postal mail to communicate with, you know, family members and relatives and build this family tree. And then he got the IBM PC in 1980 and he got this family tree software, and we used to treasure this database, like, oh my gosh, what if anything happens to this data, you know, this disk on my dad's so we'd back it up. And then when you know, because he had passed away, and the family's like, well, who wants the PC with all, and I'm like, it seems to me we can get at that data with the internet and all of the sources that you have now. It's amazing what's available now.
Did you copy or transfer it over to like a ancestry type thing, or did you just leave it on the computer?
Nah, we just left it on the computer.
Yeah.
You are
the most well-prepared guest I've ever
had. All right, what do I get?
You win. You get a copy of the book.
All right.
Woo. Oh, these notes. I felt like you just sent me the outline for your leadership book. Like this.
All
is
right, let's work
should,
on
this
it.
This is what.
Can you gonna help me get published?
Yes. Yes. Learning, building a learning culture. Knowledge is different than understanding. I loved that. Right. I like how you separated this idea of, you know, book studies are accumulating knowledge.
Yeah.
People feel like I read the book on rockets and now I'm a rocket scientist.
Yeah. Or it's entertainment.
Yes.
Which is okay. You know, I mean, if we say we're going to get together and we're going to read a book and it's going to be for pleasure and that's our intention, I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
But if we're going to start a business and there's a certain book that's going to give us some background understanding that we're going to try to put to action to help us, well, that's different, right? And so, I mean, that's money.
Yes.
It's not just play. So
you used a word I didn't know, so I always ask this. Uh-huh. What is this?
Perturbation.
Yeah, what's that?
Yeah. So perturbation is it is your nervous system's response to an external interaction.
Okay.
So right now you're getting perturbed by the light that's hitting your retina, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to pretend like I'm a biologist. I mean,
we're going to put you on the show.
Yeah, no,
Bill
no,
the biologist.
No. So I take, you know, just like I'm interested in the brain, I take what I can from things. But so like a you know how like you if you trigger somebody and mm-hmm. they get upset with you, and like so you say something and they respond and they're upset, that was a perturbation against their nervous system.
Yeah, my dad used to say perturb.
You perturb me.
Yes.
You trigger me. You we live in perturbations all day long. I mean, that's how we
it's like being affected by the world.
So there's a group that I study with out in California that just amazing people. But one of the books that we study is called The Tree of Knowledge, and I'm leading my management team. It's optional; they don't have to do it. I do have things that I say are mandatory, but this one's optional, and I've got most people are coming. But it's one of the most amazing books. I've read it 4 times, and I still don't feel like I know it. And it's one of those that'll never. In fact, I'm on my second copy because the pages are falling out of the first one. It's just a classic, and it's a book on biology, but it's got biology, it's got linguistics, which gets into language, it's got Heideggerian philosophy, and it forms the basis for a lot of how I think and how I work. And you know, if you take Daniel Pink's Right Brain, the whole New Mind, it takes that concept, but it explodes it out from a biological perspective.
You're the third person that's brought that book up to me.
Oh, really?
So now it's going to go on my
audio. Oh, you have to read it.
Yes.
You have to read it, yeah. And it's the thing about reading it is if you read it, think about it as a business person.
Okay.
Not as a, like you're studying biology.
Got it.
Because it's the last chapter is just amazing, you know.
And you can use the analogies and the structures to apply to other things.
Yeah, and a lot of it is like one of the things it talks about this and those people that have studied with me, the one, if there's one thing, one of the like say there's 5 things that they really hold on to and remember and use, one of them is that where people hold on to their certainties about things, and it's very dangerous and it's very limiting, and it's one of the things that I work to make sure I'm not holding on to. So like a certainty a long, long, long time ago was that the earth is flat.
Yes.
Right? And we held that for a long
time. And we were the center of the universe.
Right. Exactly. And there's so then you, if you start thinking about that, it's like, well, where else are people being certain about the way things are? And so all day long, you know, I'm looking out for my own certainties. Like, where do I think I know? Like one of the things the book talks about is there's a little exercise you can do, and on the page there's a plus sign and there's a dot, and if you stare at the plus sign and you bring it close to your face, at some point in time the dot disappears. And what it's revealing is, and as you're reading it, the lights, you know, is perturbing, you know, your nerve, your eye. At some point in time there's a spot in your eye where the optical nerve attaches, and you can't, it's not sensitive to light. And it's basically, so when we talk about blind spots, I don't know if you knew this, but you actually have a blind spot because your eye is not possible. So then it's like, if you say, well, as a human being, if that's the case with my eye, where else do I have blind spots?
Yes.
And just being aware of that keeps you sort of nimble and open to, well, things might not be as they seem.
Yeah, it's like when we go somewhere for the first time, it feels like it takes a lot longer. Because it's all new data to us.
Yeah.
And when we go somewhere again, our brain's backfilling the surroundings and everything. So that,
Yeah, that's, I was just talking to somebody. We were in a meeting one day. We were like at the, you know, little chit chat at the beginning of a meeting. We were talking about how, you know, somebody, the older I get, the time flies. And he said, you realize what that is? And I said, well, why does time fly? He goes, because as you age, you experience less newness. And so it feels like time flies. As a child, you know, you're taking all these things in, and it just seems slower. And so I don't know about that. I'm pondering.
I have a better math one for that.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Because I was pondering on that. Like, yeah. Why is that?
I thought you were going with my favorite one. That I.
No, I'm interested in this.
Okay.
So
when you go from zero to one, and then you go from 1 to 2, you relived 100% of your life. But when you go to 2 to 3, it's a less percentage. So every year is a less overall percentage of your entire life.
And so that's good.
It mathematically goes faster.
Huh.
Because of the amount of, the way, it's your perception of time.
Uh-huh.
And so I actually built, when I was trying to stand out, because I wanted some really cool job. This was probably about 5 years ago. Uh-huh. And it was a job that was like better than I should be applying to, but to be creative and stand out, I built a time perception calculator. Because you perceive time differently than your children.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
That's why everything seems so long and they're so impatient.
Yeah.
Because to them, they just relived a larger portion of their life than you did in a day.
That's interesting.
Their day seems longer.
Yeah.
And if you think back to your memory as a child, those days seemed really long.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah.
You're like on and on forever.
Yeah. You just
wanted. But they haven't. The time hasn't changed a bit. It's still 24 hours.
Right. It's just our perception.
Well, yeah, the perception. You know, people say perception is reality, but that is so true.
Yeah. Yes. One of the things that stood out to me that instantly positioned you as one of my favorite leaders is that you put on your notes here, you help employees rise above this cloud paycheck mystery.
Mm.
Make it clear. You make it clear what the value is.
I try to.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the challenges I find myself in is speaking to people's background, like when I talk to people, in a way that they really understand what I'm saying. And that sounds obvious, but, you know, so for example, let's say I knew nothing about computer science or computers at all, and I come in and you're talking to me, you're gonna speak, because you know I know nothing about computers, you're gonna speak to me in a way that so I can kind of get it. And but this concept that I'm talking about is challenging, because I think we were all raised, unless you grew up an entrepreneur or you've actually been an entrepreneur. Like when I was younger, I did all kinds of things to make money and somebody actually gave me cash. So if I wondered what my value was, it's like, like 1 year I sharpened people's skates. I used to work at a skating rink and I bought this device and I'd sharpen skates and they would give me $20 or whatever it was. And I knew what the value was I offered because they felt like the sharpened skates were worth $20.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about the corporate environment and you get everybody's working, customers are buying product, revenue's coming in, we're spending money on new containers, money's going out, and at the end of the day, there's a surplus of cash, and then some of that's used to write paychecks. And while how do you know? So if I give somebody a paycheck, how do I know what the value is? I mean, how do I calculate the value of what they produced or what their offers were, or as like in an entrepreneurial world? And so I talk about that, and talk about there is the market,
mm-hmm.
and there is, you know, what Java software engineers are going to make or business analysts. But if you start thinking about yourself as an entrepreneur, even though you're in the corporate world, and you think about the broader marketplace, like forget the company you work at. Think of yourself as, I can go make offers anywhere. What's the value of what you're doing? And how does what you're doing help the company? Because like one of the things I tell people is, if I said, if you're in an elevator with the CEO and he asks, hey, what do you do? If you say, I'm a business analyst, or I'm a software engineer, or I write Java, yeah, that's true from a tactical perspective, but what do you really do for the company? You know, I write software so that our customers can get their containers as quickly as possible and the most easily way to take care of their needs around their moving. Or, you know, I'm helping you increase revenues for this company. Or I'm working on reducing our costs so that next year our EBITDA is going to be better. That's what they care about. That's where the value is. And you're not getting a check because you're writing Java. And I think, and one of the things that I used to do, I did at my last company, was worked, because one of the things we heard on employee feedback from employee surveys was, I don't know how I fit into the company. And I thought about that. I'm like, okay, how do I help people know how they fit in the company? Well, it's their value. Well, what's their value? And we actually had some breakout sessions during an all hands where we all created value narratives. It's like, okay, you need an elevator speech, and it's not, I write Java. It's, you know, I am helping the company. I am helping customers take care of their transportation when their car is wrecked, you know, at Enterprise or whatever. And because, you know, if you think about the difference between money and currency, you know, currency is cash, and yeah, you get a paycheck, but money is the value. Money is an exchange of the value.
Right.
So anyway, I don't know if that makes sense, but
no,
that's,
it does.
Those are the comments. But it's, and a part of it is to get people to think and out of the busyness of the workday, and then more into like the actions that they're in to take care of whatever commitments and obligations that they have.
It's like with pods, right? A lot of reasons people use, or a recurring reason, mm-hmm. is moving their family.
Yep.
So you can almost build the story of the family who's going to, you know, they're upgrading, taking a more prosperous job and taking a big step in their uh-huh. career, and you fit into that life cycle. So it's like, I may be doing something with GPS coordinates, right, of tracking our uh-huh. pods as an engineer. Yep. But what that's really helping doing is reduce the cost of lost pods so uh-huh. that we can allow it to be more cost effective for families to take opportunities and be able to move across the country and improve their lives. And so if you connect your scripting back to that happening as uh-huh. a mental image, that it's not nonsense. It's reality. Uh-huh. Like, that's why you're doing yeah. it. And so connecting your work back to the value that you bring the customer is incredibly important. It's yeah. motivating.
Yeah. Yeah. We often talk about, I think our mission statement, a big part of our mission statement is giving our customers a peace of mind. Because if you've ever had anything in a container and you don't know where it's at, it's a little nerve-wracking, you know, especially...
You track containers? I just made that up.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And they're called containers, by the way. Apparently, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Not Kubernetes.
Not pods. Not right. But yeah, and so if a customer cares about their belongings and knowing where they're at, or they care about the driver showing up on time, then we need to take care of that customer concern.
Now, you've said, you know what, just... triggered in my head. You've said that when you handed me one of these little toy containers.
Yes.
Right. That have the pods logo right. on them. And now it's running, what can't stop looping through my mind is how Google kept asking people to stop Googling it because they were going to lose their trademark on it. Do you guys not want people calling the pods pods?
No.
Okay. Is that it's the trademark thing, right?
It's the trademark thing.
Yeah, because right. Google made this.
Yeah, and a lot of our competitors call their containers pods.
Do they really?
Well, legally they don't now.
They don't now, yeah.
Yeah, and because the pods stands for portable on-demand storage, and oh. it's just coincidental that it's on the side of a white box container, and so people just naturally call it pods.
Got it.
Yeah, which makes sense. I mean, you know, it's, you know, I think for years people called Band-Aids Band-Aids.
Right.
But it really was an adhesive strip.
Oh, wow. Yes.
Right. So, but from a branding perspective, it's wonderful. I mean, I think, you know, we've got a couple 100,000 billboards moving around the country.
Right. Oh, that's so yeah. good to think about that.
Yeah. My brother called me once and he goes, I'm glad you guys are doing good with your business, but I hope somebody will just take that white box off across the street that I have to look at every day. I think somebody's living in there now.
So. Oh, no. I saw one at Synapse. You were at Synapse then, or did you know
yeah.
that? There was
yeah.
one out front,
yeah.
big container
yeah.
out front.
Yeah. Yeah. We also do commercial applications now.
Oh, okay.
We're getting, you know, we've been in it for a while, but that's kind of a focus area is focusing on commercials. So, for example, a Walgreens might want to remove all of the fixtures in the cosmetic section.
Got it.
And over a weekend, we can put all the new fixtures in a container, and we have steel containers. We're buying more steel containers and fill that in, prepare it with a kit, and then they can do it for a whole bunch of stores, and then all those containers can go out in the parking lots, and over a weekend, Monday morning, they can have a whole new finish on the inside, and they take the old ones out and put them, and we take them back. So that's just one application. But, you know, we're showing up at concerts for, you know, merchandise. So like,
oh, yeah, smart.
And as the concert touring committee or groups move around, they run out of merchandise, and so the containers can always be filled with merchandise and sort of act as a staging inventory and
mobile.
Yeah,
inventory.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's smart.
I was explaining to somebody else where I work now, and they go, "Oh, you sell Space and Time."
Ooh.
And I'm like, "Yes, we do, actually."
That's
if
nice.
If you think about it, yeah. And then you start thinking about the different form factors that you can get into around that, because it's convenience. I mean, we used to have pretty nice patio furniture back in St. Louis. I thought it was nice. You know, I spent a lot of money on it, and I didn't want to leave it outside over the wintertime because the mice get in and things. And there was a couple years I'd go get my son. We'd rent a U-Haul truck, go to the U-Haul, come back, load up, go to the fixed storage, come back. And just logistically, it was tough. And then I thought, you know, I'm going to try pods and get containers. And it was wonderful because they brought it and put my patio furniture in, and they took it and moved to put it in the storage center. And it was just so much more convenient.
What's the size of Pods Technology organization?
We have about 70 employees right now, and we have about equal number of consultants, contractors right now, because we're building a new system.
Okay.
So you
leverage some outside to build a new system.
Yeah, and then, since I've been there, I think for a long time it's been about half and half.
Okay.
Half employees, half contractors.
So about 70 in IT, but then with your new system, it's about like 140.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And then once this new system's done, it'll probably ramp down to. We'll probably always have about 20% contractor consultant, either because, you know, just flexibility.
Yeah.
Or, you know, anytime you get new technology, I always want to bring help.
Yes.
Right? Anytime you do something the first time, it can be rough. And so
I know.
Leverage the vendors, right?
Leverage vendors, leverage consultants. Find people that know what you don't know, and bring
the
knowledge,
them in. Right?
Yeah.
And do it right the first time, get the help. And so, yeah. So I think that's why we'll always have some level of consulting or help in that regard.
I like the scarf. I hadn't heard that
before. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
David Rock. I haven't
heard. Yeah, have you heard of him?
No, but I'm going to look up all of these people now.
He's got a, I can't remember how I discovered him. He's got a group that he was key to forming it, called the Neuro Leadership Institute.
Ooh.
And it was kind of a brain-based leadership. And if he talks a little bit about this. He has a handbook. It's about that thick. I bought it, and it's really interesting, really good. There's really good stuff in there. But there's what I like about what he and that group do is they don't discard what's been done. So Peter Drucker, all of the greats around, you know, just historical, traditional management leadership, this, you know, timeless, fundamental, all good. You know, they're part of like the platform of leadership and management discourse. And then you have, Daniel Pink comes along, mm-hmm. and there's a, you know, emotional intelligence, Daniel Goleman, right? Is that, I think it's,
the emotional intelligence, like 2.0.
Yeah,
all those
books. I think that's Goleman.
I took it.
So you had this, new, like this layer on top that started getting into like the right side of the brain and emotion and conceptualizing. And I, for me, in addition to some of this other discourse that I'm in, the neural leadership, they're bringing brain-based. And so SCARF is I don't claim to be an expert in it, but it's been very helpful for me to know that we talked about perturbations. Mm-hmm. When we're triggered, and I'm sure you know this, when you're triggered, you can be triggered to fight or flight. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's primitive in our being. People can be triggered into fear, flight, or fight or engagement. And so in the workplace, if you think about motivating people and encouraging people and mobilizing people, you can shut them down or open them up to action. And SCARF stands for status, certainty, autonomy, relating, and what was the last? Fairness. Yeah. And so
this was not a quiz.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a while since I've looked at it.
No.
But it's just true. I mean, you know, people care about their status. They care, you know, they want certainty. Like, where, that's why people are like, what's our vision? Where are we going? And if they don't have that, they're uncomfortable.
Ooh, fun point with that. It's a lot like taking a shower. You have to do it every day. Like,
yeah.
The vision, just because you it's not like a check mark. Like, oh, at this company, I have communicated the vision. Check. I've done my leadership task. It's like a constant
thing. And we forget that as leaders, don't we?
Yes.
One of my teachers says that if you can't hold your vision statement in your mind and you don't have it like on the tip of your tongue in language, it doesn't exist.
Ooh,
so good. as soon as you lose, it's like goals or anything. You know, you write them. One of the reasons you write them down and you put them on the walls, you don't forget them, because as soon as you forget them, they don't exist. And same thing with the vision. And if we don't, it's one of the reasons politicians say the same thing over and over again in their, you know, their lobbying or their party or whatever they're doing, or running for campaign, is because they keep it in existence.
And they keep it simple so it spreads.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's what we have to do as leaders, right? autonomy, you know, if we don't empower people, if they don't feel like they're in control and we're micromanaging, they're going to shut down and they're not going to be as effective. Relation, you know, we talk about, you know, there's a lot of talk about today and millennials need to be, you know, in groups and communities. Yes, that applies to everybody.
Yeah.
We're socially oriented as human beings. It's not apply just to millennials.
Yeah.
Right?
It's
like why? It's like
they want to be in groups and tribes. It's like that's what we do as people.
Yeah. And fairness to me is about consistency. Right? It doesn't mean equal portions for everybody. It just means I'm fair in the way I approach, the way I work with my team, and it's consistent, and then that builds trust too, because they can trust that you're going to be consistent, you're going to do the right thing.
Yeah, right. That was the topic of this morning's conversation. I was down at the Ritz for Chamber. It was like the annual Chamber event, and they had a breakfast and this guest speaker who had built up Nextel.
Oh, wow.
As the COO and some other companies, he's built two or three multi-billion-dollar companies. And I was like, let's go listen to that guy.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's accomplishment.
Yep, let's go listen. And his first name is Joel. So somebody actually, a lawyer that had heard me speak at like an Ivy League event, messaged me and said, hey, this guy's name is Joel, and he's got the whole billionaire thing going on. I think you'd want to hear him speak. I have an extra ticket. Do you want to come?
Nice.
And I said, yep. She's like, does it mind that's like at 7 a.m. it's a breakfast? I'm like, nope, I'm up at 4 or 5 in the morning.
Right.
So like, I can be there. I'm an early person. Are you early?
I know. I listened to one of your podcasts. You said you're early. And I think I was walking my dog listening to your podcast, and it was 5:30, and I thought, oh, Joel's already run by now, because he says he runs in the morning.
I do. Yeah. I run in the morning, and when it's too cold, I have to go to the gym and run.
Yeah.
I prefer the outside run.
Yeah.
I like the outside run.
Yeah. Well, you get to see things, and you get the fresh
stars.
Air. Yeah. Yeah. The only time I like, I don't mind, I don't run a lot, but like if I do, I like to do, it's called, well, there's different names for it. What I heard it is peak eight.
Okay.
And so I like to do that on a treadmill just because I can get it over with quick. But it's basically like 8 wind sprints for 30 seconds,
that's
but
cool.
You take like 90 seconds in between.
That's cool.
It's like interval, or there's other names for it. But
yeah, when I for a while there, I was going to a spin class,
mm-hmm.
and they have that concept of like, it's a lot of intensity and a
lot
of break.
Yeah.
And a lot
good
of
for your heart, good for your brain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, I feel alive.
Yeah.
I feel really alive after my morning workouts.
Yeah. You got a great story, by the way. Your car wreck. Do you ever talk about that?
Yeah, you know, I don't talk about that on the show a lot. But did you see the video?
I haven't seen the video. Is it okay if I bring it up?
Yeah, it's okay.
I mean, I'm fascinated by people's story, especially adversity and what they go through. And dude, that's huge what you went through and like how you went through, like, and that's just, I mean, I just that stuff shapes you.
Yeah.
So
it was a garage sale day. January 20th, and I was about like 11, 12-ish, and this girl sort of lost control of her car and hit me, and my back, like my legs and stuff went like under the back tires, and then I woke up and they were drawing chalk around me because they were going to put me in the ambulance, and for the investigation, they have the tire marks and where the person, but like when they were drawing chalk around me, I was like, am I dead?
Did you remember that?
Yeah. Huh?
You remembered, like...
Can I remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes a shock of situations.
Oh, I wasn't in pain.
Okay.
That was the thing I remember most.
Yeah.
Is I woke up and I just like, I was fine. And I saw him drawing chalk around. I was like, what's going on? And then they put me in the back of the ambulance and started driving. And it wasn't for probably like 10, 15 minutes that I started before I felt the pain.
Oh, wow.
And they were putting like drugs in me. Because they're like, he's going to feel it.
Yeah,
minute.
It's coming.
He's like,
oh,
and
my gosh.
They like tap on me like, are you feeling
pain?
Isn't
that amazing, the body, and you couldn't feel it?
Yeah, like shut it
that's
off.
I wonder if that's creation's way of protecting.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the moment at least, right?
Right. And so I was like, okay, cool. People call it the word shock, but I wasn't shocked. Like it was my nervous system that did something for me.
Because
I was like very conscious, like I just got hit by a car and I'm in the ambulance right now. So then I started rehab, and I was in the wheelchair for a while. Halfway through, I don't know if this is in the book, but halfway through my rehab, I fell and re-broke my leg.
Read that, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so I did put it in there.
Yeah, you put
I don't
it
know
there.
About the editor. Sometimes they edit.
Yeah, that was in there, yeah.
Okay.
Because I got that part, I'm like, oh my gosh, poor kid going through this.
Yeah, so then fell, re-broke my leg, got through it. It was really humbling, you know, going through puberty and then having like a nurse have to like take care of you.
Yeah.
Like that's, it's not like fantasy style, it's like embarrassing.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and so doing the showers and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So that taught me not to be a jerk, right? Be nice and humble. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I got fat. I don't know if that was in the book. Mm-hmm. It was. Yeah, so I got really fat.
Put on a bunch of weight.
Yeah, put on a bunch of weight. And then decided that, you know, it's high school, you know, late high school, and everyone was, you know, doing the dating thing. And I wasn't dating because I was big. And so I was like, I want to experience that side of life. Uh-huh. So I had this friend, Caleb, uh-huh. who was thin. And so I started mimicking him, uh-huh. mimicking his eating behaviors. I tried diets, but I was crashing yeah. and like it just yeah. wasn't working.
Yeah.
Now I understand it's discipline. Anything works if you work it for long
yeah.
enough
yeah.
with consistency. Yeah. But at that point in time,
yeah.
I was like, let's just follow Caleb. And I did, and it worked, and it was great. So
that's great. Good, yeah. good that he was there for that, right?
Right, yeah.
I saw when I downloaded your book, there was Beast Audio. Is that yours, too?
Oh, yes.
It's out there. Well, what is that?
We'll edit that out of the podcast. Yeah. Get this. Oh. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully, Jake, if you're out there, you might...
You just brought it into the office.
No, I was going to talk to you first before...
No, please. That no, yeah. please. It was a matter of time. Let me tell you, I did this project as a consultant for this company, and they were like, did some government work. Uh-huh. So there was like a lot of background investigation uh-huh. and stuff. It was a big project. And it's like 2 years ago, so probably a year after I did it. And they ended up replacing the conference line hold music with one of the tracks. And so they had me come in to do one of this like conference call with like some military, like whatever. And it was the pre-music for it.
Okay.
And I was like, that's hilarious. I loved it. I have a brother-in-law who's a famous music producer.
Really?
And so there's a song called like Best Day of My Life. It's like do 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 do. It's like it was
who was the author? Who is there?
Oh man, now I don't know. I forget. American Authors.
Yeah. Yeah, I played that last year at my niece's wedding.
Oh, you did?
Guitar, yeah.
You played it on the guitar?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So the banjo whole thing. So he made the song. He's the producer.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So they found American Authors in Boston at some bar, and they had gotten together, and they said, hey, you know, why don't you come up to mm-hmm. Westchester where they live in New York, and we'll record some stuff and we'll try to work it out. I found out the way they actually do these recording sessions is they come to his house, right, or their uh-huh. studio, and they spend 3 or 4 days together and they write an album. They put down the first version of the album. Then they slowly let people come in and do different parts and like the
start
producer.
Start layering.
Yeah, they start layering it. Yeah. Having they'll have like guest drummers mm-hmm. come in just to put it down or
yeah.
something.
Yeah.
And then they start, he adds a bunch of instruments and then he's like, the art is taking away. So they start taking away different parts.
Yeah.
So they over at, and yeah. they couldn't get the song right. And then they were like stressing out about it. And they're like, why don't we just flip that one to be a banjo? Right, this like specific style uh-huh. of banjo, and they flipped it into the banjo, and they're like, "That's it. That's what's gonna make the song." So that was something that you know wasn't originally in the song. It was in post production. Yeah, they switched it to a banjo, and
you know what's else is interesting is, and I know we're off topic here.
No, it's fine.
What else is interesting is I have I played guitar with a friend of mine. He was a country artist and working, you know, doing a CD and this sort of thing. And went to Nashville, and I didn't record on his CD, but I was in the studio with him. And, you know, there's all these different musicians, you know, Carrie Underwood's, you know, fiddle player and all these people. And we were talking about how they record the core song mm-hmm. and then they'll have tracks with instruments for country, mm-hmm. like a fiddle and a steel guitar, a banjo. And then they'll do addition of tracks for the pop stations, mm-hmm. you know, so electric guitar and a keyboard. And then so they do a track for the pop stations and they take out all of the sort of the country pixie dust and then they kind of flip it for the other. And I just thought that was fascinating. Just the way they're thinking about it's the same song.
Yes.
Right. But it's two different sort of arrangements and for two different genres.
Yeah. They make another fun fact that I like is people who watch TV when they do like the little promo for a show that's gonna come out, it's like Saturday,
yeah,
whatever. They actually have to make that like a song and then they clip it out because of like some licensing issue. So they will write a small song.
I wondered about that.
And specifically make it like that.
Oh yeah, because I always wonder like they're ripping off something here.
Yeah.
How are they doing it?
Yeah. So you make it a song, And then they just clip that section of it. You can't just make the 15-second clip.
Okay.
And I was like, well, that's cool. Because
yeah.
They do stuff for like Pepsi commercials.
Yeah.
It's also very, like, any area I go in life, I realize this. It's very relationship driven. So there's great songs that they make, some songs that are better than others. Mm-hmm. But because of the relationships, as the world is turning, people, favors and friends and like...
It's all networks.
It's all networks. And so sometimes the network is busy and they have a great song. And so it just doesn't, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Because having a great song and then having it get on the, into the consciousness of like society, two different things.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was hanging out with me and we were like, hey, I talk a lot and people like my family and stuff, they'd say I'm very motivational like when I'm talking. Mm-hmm. So he's like, and I was writing at the time. Mm-hmm. I was just writing these motivational things for myself. Uh-huh. Like, and he's like, oh, we should record them. Like, let's just record some. And I was like, all right, cool. I was like, I've never done this before. He's like, yeah. He's like, just take some of the things that you write. And like, I think it was like a grandparent or some farther removed relative had passed away. So he flew down. He's like, let's just record some stuff. I'm like, okay, let's do it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And so it was fun. And so we did that. And it's comes up on my AirPods sometimes because it's in my Apple Music. Uh-huh. I make like $200-$300 a month off of that.
Well, I'll buy that too. I wanted to make sure I knew what it was before I bought it. Well, I didn't know if it was you. I mean, it had the same name, right?
Yeah, no, it's me.
I figured it was. So.
Oh, it's motivational like speeches, essentially. Okay. Like motivational rants.
I'll have to download it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would write them like while running on the treadmill or something. Or
nice.
Cooling down on the treadmill. But you gotta find ways to stay motivated. Because motivation is like, it's ephemeral, right?
Yeah. You know, one of the things I started to do some writing about this. In fact, one of the things I was thinking about probably 3 or 4 months ago was the importance of bringing creativity, passion, art into the corporate environment. Mm-hmm. Like if you watch an artist, whether it's an actor and a painter, musician, and you look at the passion and the intensity with what they do, if everybody in the corporate environment worked with that kind of passion and intention and creativity and discipline, can you imagine what the output of the company would be? And I'm not saying people aren't doing that or they don't intend, but it's kind of a concept. And so I was even thinking about this. In fact, I actually bought the URL and was thinking about playing around with it, this concept of the corporate artist. Mm. But if when you hear that, it might think, oh, somebody paints for company. Like the way, how that perturbs somebody, like, well, what does that mean? Maybe not be it. But I was thinking there's something there that I'm interested in talking about.
I believe the people have it inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
Often they almost, it's like they need permission to express it. Like I think more people feel like that inside.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's something shutting them down.
Yeah.
You know, I talked about the scarf model.
It's yeah.
Like, it's like, well, what, is it fear? Is it, belief you have to bridle it or heart, filter it or whatever. Where if people would just be their authentic self and be able to flourish naturally within the ethics of the company or whatever. But
that's the hard part. There's always advice and then there's the way people misinterpret it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, but I liked when I was reading your notes about if you create, one thing I do with my team is, specifically at Courtney. And she was reaching out and getting quotes from people, mm-hmm. and for this book we're putting together, mm-hmm. like 365 days of technology leadership quotes, and some people were writing longer stories, and I was like, oh, just cut it down and find a good line in there, mm-hmm. that you can use. You don't have to publish the whole story. Mm-hmm. She's like, but then I'm editing their work. Won't they be upset at me? And I said, if they do, I will take ownership of it. Like we can say I did it, uh-huh. or whatever. But by constantly taking, and that happens a lot in little different situations, mm-hmm. by letting them know that, look, if this comes back, I'll own it for you. Mm-hmm. It will not come back to you. I will.
Yeah,
that
you got their back.
That creates the environment that they can do stuff.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah.
That's really good. And that's safety for them.
That's what I liked about your writing. Yeah.
They can be freed up by that. Yeah. That's really good.
Yeah, it creates that environment. It's like, hey, you can make mistakes and it will never come back on you. Because that's what people are so scared
about.
That's
good leadership.
Yeah.
That's good for you, man.
Yeah. You're fantastic.
You want to call my wife and tell her that?
Yeah, I'll write a letter.
My children.
No,
No, I was looking. I was looking forward to meeting you, and I like listened to a few of your podcasts, and just your energy and your passion, and your enthusiasm. It's contagious for sure. I'm sure you've heard that before.
I love it. I just like getting to talk. Like, this is my job, and for me, that's unbelievable because I thought that I would have to like pursue an alt. I didn't see it happening like this, and I thought it was a lot farther away than it mm-hmm. was. And I stopped thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I stopped imagining it and instead took the time I was spending imagining it and just started taking one step, like, closer to it. Right? And so that is, I think my takeaway from this experience is that it takes less work and time than you would imagine. I know everyone says the opposite, like, it takes way more time. But if you replace all the time you spend daydreaming of a different future mm-hmm. and just replace that with taking action towards it.
That's really good.
It just
happens. Really good. You need to write that. Yeah. Get that off the recording.
I think they're recording it. Yeah.
Yeah, you got that. Hopefully Jake didn't have the machine turned off. That was good.
Oh, man. No, but that's what it was. And it's changed everything. And my entire life has changed in the past 2 years.
Yeah.
And like, I like it, and so I'm excited about what's going to happen over the next 20 years.
Yeah. What's your number one purpose for what you do?
Right now?
No, just in life. Like if somebody said it's my podcast now. Okay. I'm asking.
Yeah, no, the Bill Tingle podcast.
If somebody said you can only say one thing, your purpose in life, what would it be?
Yeah, helping, teaching people.
Yeah.
It's by far the most selfish thing I can do. I get such a biological, chemical reward from it.
Yeah.
It's
selfishly altruistic.
Yeah, yes it is. I'm a huge fan of that concept because I used to cringe at that when I would hear people say that. Uh-huh. No. I used to be very dismissive. I used to be negative. I used to think the self-help stuff was nonsense and garbage. Mm-hmm. And it's because I grew up in this environment, and I don't know, no one specifically said it to me, but the feeling mm-hmm. was that they're, you know, the not good salespeople, right? The motivational speakers. Oh, mm-hmm. it's just garbage. They're just mm-hmm. going to sell you stuff that's not true. And they're just mm-hmm. there to sell books. And they're just mm-hmm. saying that hype. Mm-hmm. So I have this negativity about it. And I guess I got frustrated enough with not getting what I wanted out of life because I have mm-hmm. a natural drive. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, let's go try the one thing that I haven't tried mm-hmm. in 30 mm-hmm. years. And like, let's see if that works. Mm-hmm. Let's start taking the things that I'm certain about and questioning mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. And I real quick found out mm-hmm. that all that self-help stuff, mm-hmm. and incrementally improving yourself over mm-hmm. time, that works.
The real test is in the outcomes, right?
Because
self-help's gotten a bad rap.
And yeah.
There's probably a seeming cheesiness with some of it, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But for me, the real question is, I'm open to all of it. The question is what's it going to produce? Unless it's entertaining, and that's okay.
Yeah.
So if the end is I want to be entertained, then okay, I've accomplished what I wanted to accomplish. But if no, I want to produce something, and I can produce it, then call it self-help, call it knowledge. It doesn't matter, right? It's like I'm producing something with this.
Yeah, you just get frustrated enough to where it's like results. It's like I even remember those moments. You know, I was thinking to myself, I just need to find something that works. Just like show me something that works on like a physics level mm-hmm. in business and in life. Like I need something real. And then I started, you know, following some of the like Jim Rohn's type people. Yeah. Like I listened to Tony Robbins, I was like, that's cool. But then I heard in one of his speeches that his mentor is Jim Rohn. Yeah. Like, I'm going to put Tony Robbins over here. I'm going to learn from his mentor.
Yeah.
And then I learned Jim Rohn's mentor is this guy named Earl Schell.
Oh, yeah.
And then I started listening. He doesn't have much content because it gets dated.
Yeah, It's funny. I got how old are you? Can I see you?
31.
31? Gosh, to be 31 again. That's awesome. You've done a lot at 31. That's congratulations for you. But I remember my late 20s and probably early 30s. I'd go to the library and I'd check out this package of cassettes. And it would be like Jim Rohn cassettes or, you know, all the whole Nightingale Conant, right? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't in sales. A lot of them were meant for salespeople. But I'd go check them out because I just – and it wasn't just made me feel good. There were ideas in there about how to get organized and how to treat people and how what people's needs are and how to interact and how to – you know, like whether it's influence, not manipulative influence, but just how to – you know, I would say now how to trigger people to action.
Yeah.
And but I remember I'd put those cassettes in, you know, and then I'd take them back and get another set of cassettes. And
yeah,
of course, now you just download it off.
Every morning.
Yeah.
Every morning.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding you. My alarm clock goes off. I use this thing called Sleep Cycle that like tracks my sleep and everything. Uh-huh. And AirPods go in, and it's like either Jocko, who's like a Navy SEAL guy that has a podcast talking about discipline, or it's Jim Rohn, uh-huh. or it's Les Brown. It depends on my day.
Yeah.
Sometimes I need some rah-rah speeches. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I need some tactical things. Yeah. And so I have my different people for my different my different things. And so, I mean, yeah, the word self-help does kind of have like a cheesy thing to it, but it works. And the moment you start getting into that orbit of that class of people, it's the rule. Uh-huh. They like all the really successful people do it. Uh-huh. Like they all are reading those types of books and they're all, you know, it's just, it's like, that's what works.
Yeah.
Advice to your past self. Like, let's say for like first time leader advice, we have a lot of technologists that they're engineers. They've maybe been in the job for, you know, 3 years. They're pretty good at their technical craft. They want to make that transition to team lead. What would you tell them?
Find those people that are doing what you aspire to do. Make an assessment of if they're truly great or they're accomplished. Like, look for their accomplishment. Look for the person they are. Are they humble? Are they open? Are they appreciative? And then on a nonstop basis, look for ways to help them and ask, you know, like offer to help them. Look for what they need, the help they need, and just help them, help them, help them, help them, help them. And not worry about what you get in return, because by coupling and interacting with those people, it's going to shape you, just like if you're listening to self-help, you know, it shapes you because you're coupling to that. And do it with sincerity. And, you know, I have people at work that do that, you know, and they're always offering to help. Sometimes it's, hey, can I get you a power strip and some flip charts on the way down to your meeting? And it's like, yes, thank you so much for doing that. And, or, you know, sometimes it's not, you know, technology help or software help. It's just help. And to me, that would be one of the things.
That's what has made everything for me. Like, I do these helpful calls with people all the time. We call them micro strategy calls. And so, I mean, I've got three of them today.
Yeah.
Okay. So I get on the phone with these people, CTOs of all shapes and sizes, and I let them ask me questions, and then I'll share if I have insight there. And if I don't, I'll connect them with someone in my database who would know that area. Like, for example, one guy just got finished a round last week with for $100 million.
Wow.
And he's like, oh, I asked around and like they said go talk to Joel. And I was like, what? I was like, that's cool, because the people that they asked didn't have experience at like a higher level. Well, I have a couple people that I know that have been at that level. I have, Joel Beasley has not been at that level. But I shared the general topics of what they talked about with their struggles, and then I connected them to each other so that they can, you know.
That's great. One of the things that made me think about is we were talking recently about how we value ourselves and how we value others. And we often forget that the value of Joel isn't just Joel. The value of Joel is Joel's network. So, like, you are your network. You have to be today. And, you know, long, long, long time ago, it would have been you at a machine, you know, whatever you do in the factory. But today, Joel's value isn't just Joel. It's your whole network. It's your team here. It's like you said, it's that person who just got the $100 million round. It's, you know, all your reach. And then, so that's why when people say, I need a network, it's like, well, why do you know why you need to build your network? Your network is money.
Yeah.
I've had people, they set up an appointment with me to network. I'm like, that's fine. You know, it's just going to be a social session unless you know why you want to network. And if you say, no, I want to network because I need help. And how can I help you first? And then how can you help me? And be conscious of who you're networking with, because you are your network from a capability and a value perspective. It's huge.
Yes, and then learning when I'm listening to these billionaires speak and their speeches and everything like that, you learn so much because they share.
Yeah.
They want to help other people because it comes down to who's willing to do it.
Yeah.
And so, to your point, there's specific ways to ask for help. Like, for example, like if I want help in, let's say, sales, uh-huh. from a sales, popular salesperson uh-huh. that writes books and stuff, uh-huh. I'm not just going to Google popular salesperson and just to send them a question. I'm going to find them, read every piece of content they've produced uh-huh. on sales, look at two or three other people that are their uh-huh. peers in the space, come up with a question worth asking, because uh-huh. 99% of my questions are going to be answered that I have right now from uh-huh. that 101 uh-huh. content. Come up with questions worth asking and then send them that, because they validate you based off of the questions you're asking.
Yeah.
When people are asking me 101 questions, I'm like, just Google it anyway.
Yeah. And the way I think about that is in terms of cost and money, in terms of time, energy, in that there's an opportunity there that you say, okay, if I want to learn or get some, you know, helpful information, you know, what cost can I take on to get as much of what's available already? And then what's not available, that's the part I want to, I'm playing back on what I heard yeah. from you. The other thing that you just triggered me to think about is there's a group of us that study together across the country. And one of the things we talk about is, and it goes back to offering help. If somebody says, how can I help you? And there are some times where they're putting the cost on me. They're putting the burden on me to figure out what do I need to do to help, versus if you can spend enough time figuring out what my needs are, what my concerns are, and make an offer, like have a plan of how you're going to help me, then I don't have to think about it, and you've given me a gift. And that's, to me, that's more valuable, because I'll have sometimes people say, hey, what can I do to help you? I'm like, that's too much. That's going to take my time and energy to figure that out. I don't know right now. Now, if it's, hey, could you take the flip charts and the extension cord down, that's different. But if it's complex and it's there's a strategy behind it, that's, you know, go do the work.
Yeah. It's like if they're being lazy about trying to be valuable to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that goes back to the thing about if you go back and teach, you know, if I could tell my younger self something, it would be to just continually make offers of help to people who are influential and are in situations I want to be in, but not just say, how can I help you? I would be looking for ways that my help is valuable to them. And I would design it, not ask them to.
Yeah, you would act as a consultant. You'd figure out.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. That's great advice.
Yeah.
This is fantastic conversation.
Yeah, enjoyed it. Yeah.
I'm so happy that we did the in-person podcast.
Yeah, it was fun. A nice drive down. It was funny. I was on the bridge coming, you know, I think I went to Sarasota once since I'd been here over three years. Yeah, so this is my second time down this far. Funniest thing, though, I recently got a new car. I'm still not used to it, and I've been busy. And I'm going across Skyway, and I look at my gauge, and I've got 8 miles on my tank.
Oh, no.
and I look for gas, and it says, nearest gas station, 11 miles. And I'm like, that can't be true. I'm going to have to call Joel and have him come get me. But I did manage to get off and get some gas before I got here. So
yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I know exactly what you're talking about. You come over the Skyway and there's not gas for a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's one exit too that's bad, because if you take that exit, you can't get back on.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I managed to do okay then.
So. This is fantastic.
Are we done?
Yeah, we're done.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Time flew right by. So
yeah.
Hopefully it was.
It was best. It was amazing.
Well, thanks, Joel.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah. It was good to meet you finally. Yeah. And so.
This was fantastic. Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to help, please take a moment right now to open up the iTunes app and leave a review of the podcast. If you take a screenshot of the review and text it or email it to a friend who needs to listen to the podcast, and then CC me, joel@moderncto.io. If you CC me on the email, I'll send you a copy of the Modern CTO book or give you a shout out on the podcast, whichever you prefer. We're trying to get listed on the top 100 for iTunes, and I need your help in order to do this.